Thanks for joining us for the Monday edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bradley George here with you at the GPB studios in Midtown Atlanta. I'll be here today and tomorrow. Bill Nigut will be back in the host chair on Wednesday. And with us this afternoon, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden. Buddy, good to see you.
Great to be back.
And also here with me in the studio, Republican strategist Leo Smith. Leo, great to see you as well.
It's great to be here, Bradley.
And usually Jim Galloway is here. He's with us on the air, but he's joining us from the studios at WUGA in Athens. Jim, good to talk to you.
I'm with you in spirit.
You're the disembodied voice, so that works out pretty well. Also joining us by phone from Washington is Tamar Haleman, the AJC's Washington correspondent. Tamar, good to talk to you again.
Not the only disembodied voice.
And as always, we're streaming the show on Facebook at our Facebook page. That's GPB News. And we're also on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. If you've got questions or comments, you can shoot them to us there. And I'm also going to start with a little bit of a warning here. I've been sick for the last couple of weeks, and I still have a little bit of a cough. So you might hear me clear my throat or cough a couple of times. Hopefully not too often throughout the next hour or so. But we got
That's a good reason for me to keep my distance, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. We planned that. Jim, we're going to start with you because you're in Athens and you're up there for this. There's this 3-day meeting that's happening with state lawmakers. It's something that happens every 2 years, and because it happens every 2 years, it's known as the biennial. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Okay, it's kind of built around the freshman class in every 2-year term. How are you supposed to be a state legislator? How do you fill out your expense forms? How do you file a bill? And some very, very practical information for evaluating and getting legislation out there. But what it's become over the years is a first opportunity for legislators and the governor to make to kind of make it clear what their priorities are for the coming session. Brian Kemp will be speaking here on Tuesday, where he'll probably kind of give us a first hint of what his new administration is going to look like. As you mentioned at the front end of this program, I just finished an interview with Speaker David Ralston, who is kind of he is now the old man in the Capitol. I mean, he is the guy with the experience, and his members have really put the House Republican caucus has put out a very aggressive report through this House Rural Development Council.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later on in the show. But anything else from your chat with Speaker Ralston that you want folks to know about?
Well, he is concerned, and he's taking lessons from this rural-suburban divide that showed up on November 6th among Republicans, where he lost, where 11 House members, all Republican, lost their seats in the Northern Metro Arc. I talked to him specifically about RFRA, and it's very clear he would rather
that's religious freedom legislation that's come up in the
right,
past.
Right. Yeah. He was very specific in saying that he would rather not see that come up again.
In fact, Jim, you probably know that the primary Senate sponsor ran for something else, and
Josh McCoon
got elected. Josh McCoon
ran for Secretary of State,
and the primary House sponsor, who happened to be my state representative, also lost. That was Sam Teasley. So there should be a lesson in that somewhere.
I was going to ask you, Jim, as I sit in your seat, by the way, I'll keep it warm for you. I was going to ask you if, as you spoke with Speaker Ralston, I've known him to be pretty visionary and foretelling when it comes to these changes that we were going to see demographically across the state and whether or not we were doing enough to win in purple House districts. Did he speak to what he thought the party and the caucus ought to do to deal with those changes?
Well, what he said is that the Republican Party has got to realize that it's a big tent, and you can push an issue in South Georgia or in far North Georgia. I mean, he used the example of Fannin County. Something that sells in Fannin County will not go over well in North Fulton or Gwinnett. And if you look at the list of vulnerable legislators out there, for instance, you have Jan Jones up in North Fulton. She's the Speaker pro tem. And the district next to her, that was given up by Brad Raffensperger, who is now the Secretary of State elect, that went Democratic.
Right.
He's got to be concerned with that.
So, but did he express any way to really deal with that issue for Republicans?
Well, I think the religious liberty issue is very emblematic about that. He's saying what the speaker is saying is Republicans have to go back to what people supported them for, which is small government, support for small business, and restrained spending in government. That once you get into these ancillary issues, then you start wandering away from your mission statement, and that's when you start to divide your caucus.
Well, Jim, you mentioned that the governor-elect Kemp is going to give this speech tomorrow, and that's kind of the centerpiece of this event in Athens. Most of the newly elected state lawmakers are going to be there, but two African American women say that they're going to boycott it, including State Representative Renita Shannon of Decatur. She's been critical of Kemp's handling of the election when he was Secretary of State. She was also critical of this picture that he took with a white nationalist, and she talked a little bit more about her objections to Kemp overall and why she's boycotting this speech in an interview she did with our colleague Leah Fleming this morning.
To me, I know that these are not just, you know, political differences. These are campaigns based on targeting whole communities. And so running these racist, hateful campaigns and then just calling it political differences allows people to feel comfortable, you know, in what they're doing, these candidates. And I'm ripping the warm covers off.
Jim, what are you hearing from other Democrats there about the prospect of working with Kemp and some of the ways that he presented himself in his previous role as Secretary of State?
I think you're finding among Democrats here the feeling that the issues facing the state of Georgia are a little bit too great to participate in a boycott like that. For instance, in these last two sessions, we passed some significant legislation that opens Metro Atlanta up to rapid transit. We still haven't felt its full impact, but that required a great deal of participation and support from rural legislators. And right now, what you've got is in this upcoming 2019 session, is you've got kind of the flip side of that, where legislators are starting to take up trying to create a system of transportation for rural Georgia, where you've got a declining population and no real transportation infrastructure there, and they're looking to support from Metro Atlanta legislators, many of them Democrats. For instance, Calvin Samari of Columbus. I'm sure we're not over all of the hard feelings that came across from November 6th, but this session in Athens is the one where people really start looking for allies and across the aisle. So I think those two state lawmakers, Democratic state lawmakers, are going to be in the minority. Even
Jim is
caucus.
This is Buddy is. Medicaid expansion dead, or will it be maybe some backdoor form of that brought up this time?
No, it's not dead. No, in that the House Rural Development Council report that was issued last week, one of the main thrusts of it was to redo the Certificate of Need regulation. The 1970s legislation by which the state will kind of prevent gluts of hospital care from occurring in order to keep expenses down, that's now viewed as an impediment to rural Georgia. I asked the speaker if Medicaid expansion or waivers, that's the Republican term, is Medicaid waivers, is on the table, and he said no, it's not within the House report, but he's not anticipating that it might come up elsewhere. I think this is something that Governor Kemp would have to propose in order for it to have any legs.
And it doesn't seem like he's keen on that, though.
I think you might see something in terms of a waiver, in terms of asking the federal government for a kind of a block grant that the state could spend according to its own rules. You got to keep in mind that Brian Kemp brought in former Congressman Tom Price, the ex Health and Human Services Secretary, whose job it was to deal with health care. He's now on Brian Kemp's transition team, and I think that is a sign that something may be in the works.
Tamar, I want to let you jump in here. Anything that you're curious about this session in Athens that you want to posit to Jim?
Sure. Well, Medicaid expansion was the first thing on my list, because it's something that people talk a lot about up here, and it's something that I heard from a lot of the congressional races that I've been covering as well. I'm also curious, I've been following this criminal justice reform effort here on Capitol Hill, and Johnny Isaacson is a big supporter of this bill that currently...
Collins as well.
Yeah, exactly. That we're kind of waiting to see if it's going to move in the Senate. And I'm wondering if we've heard at all from Governor Kemp, Governor-elect Kemp, or his transition team about whether they plan to continue or expand on any of the criminal justice efforts that Governor Deal championed.
Well, I would think that the answer to that is they will, because that's been the history of this Republican leadership. I mean, Georgia has been cited even by Attorney General Holder and President Obama as being leaders on criminal justice reform. And I think that one thing I know about Brian Kemp, Governor-elect Kemp, is that he sees himself as part of that leadership hand down from Governor Deal's good legislation when it comes to those issues.
Jim?
Well, I will tell you what, it's one of the things that you're going to listen for. But in the rural, with the emphasis that Brian Kemp put on rural Georgia in this last campaign, it's not something that made his, I don't think criminal justice reform was on his first tier of issues. It may be something that we see develop along the way. It will be worth listening tomorrow to see if he includes it in his list of in his wish list.
Isn't opioid abuse part of criminal justice reform with the drug courts?
It is part of that.
That's much a rural issue, right?
Right. It's very much a rural issue, and also you've heard some lawmakers like Renee Unnerman in the Senate propose. Building a Medicaid waiver to expand federal spending on health care in Georgia based on opioid addiction prevention.
All right. So we're going to take our first break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about rural development, and we're going to talk about Nick Ayers, many people thought he was going to be Donald Trump's chief of staff, but he announced he's coming back to Georgia. We're going to talk about what might be next for him. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB.
Think about all the time you've spent with GPB during 2018 and what these moments mean to you. As you support the organizations that matter to you during this season of giving, I hope you'll include GPB. Before the year comes to a close, do your part to keep GPB strong in the year ahead. Go to gpb.org and click donate to make your tax-deductible year-end gift, or call 800-222-4788. From all of us at GPB, thank you for your support and happy holidays.
Whose voice was that? Oh, that was me. Welcome back. I'm Bradley George in for Bill Nigut on today's Political Rewind. We're talking with former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, Republican strategist Leo Smith, and the AJC's Jim Galloway and Tamar Haliman. Jim, before we leave the biennial session in Athens where lawmakers are sort of doing their orientation, we got a question from Cindy Simpson on Facebook. And she was curious about who pays for this thing. Are lobbyists paying for it, or what's the deal there?
I believe it's sponsored by the Carl Vinson Institute of Government
at UGA
in Athens, and connected with UGA. But I think the state has a line item in its budget for this.
Jim, you can be assured, though, that lobbyists are lurking, and they are.
They're not just lurking; they're swarming.
And they will spend a lot of time there, and they will be doing a lot of after session entertaining and discussion. So it won't be a totally isolated thing, and I think you'll see a number of our friends from the lobbying community involved in it.
I've seen many of your old colleagues, buddy. They've got a hall full of exhibits here.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Let's move on, Jim and panel. Let's talk about you alluded to this earlier. There's this House Rural Development Council, and they've proposed a whole host of ideas about reviving rural communities in Georgia, and we could expect to see some of this in legislation when the session starts next month. But Jim, I guess my thing is, I've lived in Georgia for almost 5 years, and it's like we keep talking about these same rural issues over and over and over again. We specifically talk about healthcare. We talk about internet access, especially. And I wonder when we're actually going to start to see solutions on those things, because it seems like we've had task force and panels and reports and such. Are we actually going to see some kind of movement on this in this coming session?
Well, it depends if we can figure out a way to pay for it. And that's what makes this proposal that's come out through the Rural Development Council a little bit more interesting than past ones, because basically what they're taking, they're talking about expanding the tax on communications that Georgians pay. Right now, if you have a landline, you pay a 7% communications tax on it. The same thing on cable TV. What they're talking about is dropping that tax down from 7% to 4%, and then expanding the base of it so that it would cover dish TV, it would cover satellite TV, it would cover streaming services like Netflix, slapping a 4% tax on them that hasn't been there before. And that's where this gets interesting, because basically there was an interesting session this morning from one of Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue's people, his expert on the federal broadband portion. And you know, there were figures being tossed about how many billions of dollars it's going to take to wire rural Georgia to the point that that healthcare services can be delivered over that network, that that farmers can use it as a reliable source of communication for all their needs. If it's taking long, it's because it's a very expensive and very complicated topic.
You know, Jim, I can remember back in August of 2018 that telecommunications loan and Community Connect grant group that was put together by the United States Department of Agriculture. And Georgia didn't really have any representation on that federal group to grow telecommunications infrastructure in rural areas. And I just think that in general is a good play to have this focus on looking at where we might have actually been absent in making the case for rural development.
One other interesting thing that's worth noting, though, is what they're proposing new taxes on are forms of media that are used most commonly or a lot by millennials. You've seen this big generational shift over the last 5-10 years. You know, we're millennials like me, we aren't buying cable packages and stuff. Now they're going after things like streaming video, right, Downloaded music and stuff. So I think there's also a hope to kind of tap into a revenue base that was starting to kind of shift away from the traditional things that are being taxed.
Dan, that's a good point. In fact, most of your contemporaries don't have a landline anymore.
Oh,
and,
no way.
So what if you do tax a landline 7%? You're not getting anything to speak of these days, even if you knock it down to 4. But I proposed before, and I think we still ought to look at the infrastructure that's already out there and improving upon it. The electric memberships corporations throughout this state already have a basis for an infrastructure, and what you could do is expand broadband. They're already providing internet service, but you could supplement them somehow that they can make broadband available. There are a lot of things already out there.
Right, right, buddy. And there is some of that in these recommendations that the House is now considering. There are some roadblocks to EMCs fully participating in the broadband effort, and they're trying to bring as many entities as they can, not just EMCs, but also say private cooperative telephone service companies.
And we should mention here that there have been some rural communities in Georgia that have built out their own broadband networks. Elberton comes to mind. I believe Thomasville has as well, and I know there are some others. Tamara, I want to go back to you because Georgia has a pretty strong advocate for rural areas in the form of Sonny Perdue, who's the agriculture secretary, the former governor. What's the chance that that Washington could pitch in this effort to help rural Georgia?
Sure. Well, it's worth noting that the Department of Agriculture, which Sonny Perdue oversees, has a huge rural development program that has a big hand in everything, not only broadband, but they do a lot when it comes to sewers and education and funding police forces and stuff. It's a big conduit for federal funding to kind of make it down to rural Georgia. And I know there's been efforts underway to help out when it comes to broadband. I'm not an expert as to how much needs to be done on kind of the local state effort versus local and state level versus kind of the federal side. But it is interesting to note that his folks were there and kind of a big part of this discussion as well.
One thing he's got to be very careful about, though, is the rap on him already from the Midwest farmers is that he might favor the South or certain areas like that too much. And, of course, they were not overly enthusiastic about his becoming agriculture secretary to start with because they felt like he would abandon the Midwest and those areas where the Trump administration has been making gains.
Exactly. And that's a dynamic that you see with every Secretary of Agriculture. It's very much, farming and agriculture issues are less partisan affairs and more regional because there's different crops and different interests between kind of the ag states in the Midwest and the South and California. So this is not only limited to Sonny Perdue, but you are absolutely right. When he was first tapped for this position, there was a lot of skepticism from the Midwest. But he, at the same time, has kind of taken great pains to make sure to kind of prove to people that he's not trying to favor the South or anything. And a lot of his top deputies, he made sure to appoint Midwesterners to kind of prove that to people.
Here's a comment from Matt Schweitzer on Facebook. He says, Republicans have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo in rural Georgia because it is their power base. To urbanize rural Georgia with development that brings new business, et cetera, threatens their power in rural areas. Leo, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that when he's talking pure election politics there, and that obviously, yes, if you bring resources to a constituency that's voting for you, actually, I think that behooves you as the governing party. So I'm not real sure what he's saying, but he's saying that. But I do think that when you are elected by a rural electorate, as Brian Kemp was, that rightly so, he should make sure that he serves their interests in some way. I mean, then Republicans do have a problem. We have to be careful that we don't get so focused on legislating and leading for our constituency that we leave the rest of Georgia out and that becomes an economic problem. So the problem that Republicans are having with urban communities, losing urban communities like Orange County, California, nationally, those problems aren't just about getting elected. It's also making sure that you have a diversified economic base.
Leo, maybe I misunderstood the question, but what I think he's saying is that you've got to be careful not to educate those rural voters too much, because if they get educated too much, they'll start voting Democratic rather than going along with the rural Republicans.
Well, I understood the question. I just don't agree with that premise, of course.
Bradley, if I can step in here.
Yep.
I go to these biennial events regularly. I mean, and 2 years ago, we were in a session, and a newly elected rural Georgia lawmaker, a Republican, got up and started questioning why we were offering tax credits to all these movie and TV production companies, because all it was doing was bringing in people who didn't think like them. And there is that element in between wanting to stir business, to create a good business climate, but also realizing the fact that a good business climate changes you in ways that you might not want to change. And that's a very real concern within certain circles of Georgia politics.
One more thing I want to talk about real quick here. I imagine pretty much every House and Senate member is there at that meeting in Athens, but we've got an uncertain result in House District 28 up in Northeast Georgia, where this is actually a rerun of another election earlier this year. Excuse me. State Representative Dan Gasaway, a Republican, running against another Republican, Chris Irwin. And the final tally, Jim, shows that it's separated by just two votes.
By two votes. And the incumbent, Gasaway, is behind. And this and Republican Chris Irwin is ahead. By the way, there was no Democrat who qualified in that race. So this is essentially a redo of a primary contest from May. And what happened was that it was discovered that a few precincts that were supposed to go into that House District 28 race had been siphoned off and voters there had been sent wrongly into another House race.
Well, that's going to be very interesting to watch, and you see how important, if citizens are listening and they want to know how important their vote is. This is a perfect example of how important that vote is. And Jim, I'm sure you probably know that Gasaway's attorney is Jake Evans, the son of Randy Evans, our ambassador.
And a former guest on this program many times, yeah. Ambassador to Luxembourg.
I had no idea that that was the case.
Yes, it is.
All right, let's move on, and let's talk about Nick Ayers, who has a long storied history with Republican politics here in Georgia. He was chief of staff to Vice President Mike Pence. And after this announcement that John Kelly would be leaving the White House at the end of the year as President Trump's chief of staff, many people thought Ayers would be the heir apparent here. But Jim, has not been the case.
No. And what's more, Ayers announced this morning that not only was he out of the running for White House chief of staff, but that he was leaving Mike Pence's office as well, and would eventually will head to back to Georgia here for the new year. He'll be back. This is a guy with gubernatorial ambitions, and you don't. Even in a long-term plan, you don't run for governor from Washington, D.C. in Georgia.
Well, this is no big surprise to me, but even though I don't know Nick Ayers personally. We've met several times, but about a year ago, he bought a beautiful home over in Northwest Atlanta, right next door to a friend of mine and from another friend of mine, and he's got a beautiful place there, and it's not the kind of place that you neglect. It's a beautiful home. I think his wife and family wants to raise him in the South, and I think he wants to, his future is to be in the South. Now, he's made a lot of money, according to his reports, and I think he's in a position now, at least he has a steady base. And why in the world would anybody want to work as chief of staff for President Trump? Well, the way he abuses the people that work for him, and everybody he touches, unlike King Midas, turns not to gold, but to something not quite as valuable. So in my view, I think he's doing the right thing. Why put up with the abuse? Why put up with the uncertainty? Why not come back to a safe haven here in Georgia and continue to build your future down here?
Leo, I want to let you respond to that in a second. But tomorrow, I want to get to Buddy's point here. Since Nick Ayers made this announcement, there have been a number of names that have floated out there. And Mick Mulvaney, who was the budget director in the White House, was one of them. And all these folks have said, we're not interested in this job. What are you hearing?
Yeah, exactly. I've seen a bunch of different names pop up, including Congressman Mark Meadows from North Carolina, the chairman of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus. But what was so amazing reading all this coverage yesterday, once news emerged that Ayers was out of the running, was apparently that Donald Trump was stunned by all this. Those are not words you hear often in the same sentence. Donald Trump and shocked. He didn't really have a plan B for all of this. And for the longest time, we had a story pre-written, ready to go, because we at the the AJC and a lot of people in Washington thought Ayers was of course going to take this position. I saw a great little anecdote in the New York Times that they even had a press release ready because they thought that was the plan. But Ayers had mentioned he only wanted to be a transitional figure. He didn't want to be there for the full 2 years like what Trump wanted, somebody who could help transition him through 2020 during a pretty tough election cycle. And as Buddy mentioned, you know, this is a guy with political ambitions of his own. And this is a time we're expecting not only just a volley of subpoenas coming from House Democrats, but you have the Mueller investigation that's supposed to be wrapping up in the months ahead. Trump is a challenging person to manage at any time, but especially at this really trying time. So I can see this argument that he wanted to kind of keep a distance, be able to support from afar, but not be in the thick of it for whenever he wants to run.
Well, the President of the United States understandably demands total loyalty from all of his people. That's understandable. However, he has not demonstrated that same loyalty to those people who have fallen on the sword for him. And so I think Nick Ayers is pretty smart in stepping back and letting the world go along without him.
You know, I'm just excited for Georgia that we have such strong leadership up at the White House, from the Department of Agriculture to Senator Perdue to Senator Isaacson to young Nick Ayers, and that they love Georgia enough to make sure that they don't waste opportunities and sometimes what can be a very complicated situation at the White House. So 2020 is going to shape up to me to be an exciting time, because who knows where Nick will land as far as his political interests in Georgia.
Do you have any sense impacts of what that might be for
him? Well,
I
think that there could be a domino effect if Perdue decides, for instance, if Senator Perdue decides to run for office, whether as a vice president or as a president. Who knows what Donald Trump might do in 2020. But to have a team of people already here in Georgia back who have experience in Washington, D.C., ready to go for such a race would be pretty powerful.
Bradley, if I could jump in here.
Sure.
And because Leo raises a really interesting point, something that I kind of touched on this morning, is that if you think about one reason that Ayers might have declined this job is, think about the position that it put him in. He is Mike Pence's man in the White House right now, and he was going to become Donald Trump's top defender in the White House. And we've had this talk that Donald Trump might be thinking about dumping Mike Pence for somebody who can help him a little bit more in the 2020 Electoral College. And if that's the case, then that really puts that would have put Ayers in a very, very awkward position. And I think by cutting ties with both camps, direct ties with both camps at the same time, I think he avoids a very, very serious entanglement.
So is what you're saying, Jim, is that David Perdue could be Trump's running mate in 2020?
I'm saying that the situation is fluid, and that possibility surely exists.
Yes.
But the one thing you have to remember is that by marriage and by background, Nick Ayers is part of the Perdue clan. He is part of the family, and they have another agenda. They have agendas of their own that sometimes coincide with Trump's, and sometimes they won't.
Well, I guess we'll see. It's going to be an interesting next couple of years then, possibly in Georgia.
Stay tuned.
He's got a lot of good options. That's the only thing I can say.
Leo, who do you think should be Trump's new chief of staff?
Oh, wow.
Sorry to put you on the spot like that.
Perhaps Jesus Christ.
Okay.
Can
we tweet that out right now at the president? Let him know.
Well, look, I mean... in all seriousness, it has to be someone who's more interested in the economic agenda, the MAGA agenda, the Make America Great Again agenda, which is an economic agenda. I know people feel that that's a cultural agenda sometimes, but it's an economic agenda. And if they believe in it enough, and they believe that, you know, Trump's leadership with Congress has been such that America is benefiting greatly, they have to believe in that more than the disorder that sometimes surrounds the White House.
And isn't it also somebody who can control some of this man's impulses? And we saw that maybe a little bit with John Kelly.
That would be the least appropriate person. To walk into the White House thinking you're going to control Donald Trump automatically marks you as somebody who's going to have a tough time.
I'm not sure he won't say chief of staff in the normal way that chiefs of staff have operated in the past. He wants to be the chief of staff and then assign things he doesn't want to do to the chief of staff. I understand that perfectly. However, I would think a good situation might be like when Howard Baker was tapped to be chief of staff. He was someone who had already made his mark, someone who already
Republican
had,
senator from Tennessee.
Exactly.
Made his
mark during Watergate. He was highly respected, and he was in a position not only to stand up to the president, but also to offer some experience and advice and never worried about losing his job, because if they fired him, so what? He'd go back to Tennessee. He had a lot of options there, and he needs somebody with some independence and who not necessarily would stand up to Trump in a militaristic type of way, but at least offer him some good advice as a peer and not as a subordinate.
Tamar? It sounds like he's looking for almost a political operative in chief. He's kind of, you know, the president loves to be on the road campaigning for people. You saw that in the lead up to the 2018 midterms. And he's gearing up for what's sure to be a really nasty, ugly fight against, you know, whichever Democrat emerges out of this uncertain field. And I think that's what really attracted him to Nick Ayers eventually. This is a guy who cut his teeth working for Sonny Perdue starting when he was a teenager, worked his way up to the Republican Governors Association, became a really high-powered political operative. And it seems like as he, you know, as you see these reports that he's thinking about dumping Mike Pence, I think that's something he is going to be looking for. Who could be of great help to him on the ticket in 2020. You're starting to see names like Nikki Haley as a potential running mate, you know, perhaps to help with female voters or suburban people who maybe aren't as big of a fan of Trump's rhetoric. So I think he's looking for somebody with that keen political eye. I don't know if Mark Meadows is that person or Steve Mnuchin or Mick Mulvaney, but I think that's kind of going to be a big prism to look at all of this with.
That's a good point, but let me emphasize one other thing that we haven't discussed today, and that is once you become the White House Chief of Staff, the scrutiny that you have of everything you've done since the time you were born until the present time is out there. Every financial decision you've made, every girl you've ever dated, everything comes out, and frankly speaking, some of us will be better off without that type of scrutiny.
All right. We'll leave that discussion there, and we're going to take another break. But lots more to talk about when we come back here on Political Rewind on GPB.
On the next Fresh Air, the driverless car. We talk with Samuel Schwartz, author of No One at the Wheel. He says the future autonomous vehicles will be safer and look much different. You'll be able to sleep, eat, work, and even go on a date in them. But he warns that the car industry of the future could get too powerful at the expense of pedestrians and public transit. Join us.
It's Today at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
There are many ways to be a leader. Some run big companies. Some serve on the school board or volunteer for causes they care about. Most leaders are regular people who want to make a difference. They do it by supporting what matters to them. I'm Tamara Keith. When you give to public radio, you're supporting reliable journalism. So please, follow your heart and be a leader. Make a year-end gift now.
Go to gpb.org and click donate or call 800-222-4788.
Thanks for joining us for Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bill Nigut in for... I knew that was going to happen at some point. I'm not Bill Nigut. One Bill Nigut in this world is enough. I'm Bradley George in for Bill Nigut today and tomorrow. Bill will be back with you on Wednesday. We're talking today with former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, Republican strategist Leo Smith, and Jim Galloway, and Tamar Halliman from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, I imagine Brian Kemp's giving the speech in Athens tomorrow to state lawmakers, and we're going to find out more about his transition, more about his plans for his first year in office. Last week, we got some clues in that as well when he named his legislative floor leaders in the House and the Senate. Do anything about the choices he make there stand out to you?
No. Let me see. Brian Strickland in the Senate from McDonough.
Right.
That's fairly conservative Republican territory. Although he's from Henry County, and that area is changing rapidly demographically. So I don't know how long. I mean, that could be a 2-year job. And out. Then he's got Burt Reeves is one of many House members designated for service as floor leaders in that chamber. Reeves is from Marietta. He's the fellow who authored the adoption bill, that comprehensive reworking of the state's adoption laws that was such a focal point in the last two sessions.
And a very safe seat, Jim. A very safe seat.
Right, and yes, and it's a very safe seat, and Burt is considered a very much an up and comer. So I think those are both of those. Kemp is doing what he needs to do in picking, I think, the right people who have good relations in their chambers, because this is going to be particularly important in the Senate. Because, of course, most of your Republican senators were backing Casey Cagle, and the incoming Lieutenant Governor, Jeff Duncan, is a former House member. Now Ralston also served in the state Senate before moving over to the House, so it's been done before, but it's kind of awkward. And the House and Senate have very different operating rules, and very, very the culture is a good bit different. And
Jim, rookies with respect to leadership activity?
I think most of them, yes. I think most of them are.
They're fresh voices, aren't they? I mean, and then some of them, like Representative Jody Lott out of the Augusta area of Evans. I mean, you know, a lot of them also are from, like you said earlier, areas that are trending purple, but they're also used to working with Democrats. These are people who work in districts where they've had to engage across party.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing you have to, Bradley, in the Senate, you know, you've had a leadership shift Brian Kemp's brother-in-law, help me out here. I'm blanking on his name.
He's Bill Cowsert.
Thank you very much. He's Bill Cowsert was defeated in his effort to lead that chamber. Butch Miller out of Hall County is going to be doing that, and so it's going to be interesting to see what kind of power Senate Republicans cede to the new lieutenant governor. Because that's always, you know, if Sarah Riggs Amico had been elected lieutenant governor, she probably would have been stripped pretty much of all influence, kind of like what's going on in Michigan and Wisconsin right now. But this is still not it's still not a friendly takeover, entirely friendly takeover of the chamber. So there's going to be some really interesting negotiation over power.
Yeah,
that's going to be occurring there.
That was interesting to me because I'm thinking back. You mentioned Bill Cowsert, and I'm thinking about some of the leaders during Governor Deal's time, and their people, maybe their political allies or their geographic allies. You see a lot of people in leadership positions from Northeast Georgia, which is from Hall County. Where Governor Deal is from, and you look at this list of floor leaders, and maybe not so much for Brian Kemp, and so you have to wonder about how that dynamic is going to play out as the session gets started.
You might remember that Chip Lake, who is the chief of staff to the incoming lieutenant governor, was on this program recently, and we made that question to him in different terms, but he seemed to think that there was work to be done, but that he could negotiate and work with the members of the Senate in such a way that he would be able to retain most of the powers that the current lieutenant governor has, but that might be a long reach, especially when you consider most of them supported the existing lieutenant governor for the job.
And Chip Lake, having been the leader he's been, and this means a lot. I mean, Jeff Duncan has a very strong team of people joining him as lieutenant governor.
Bradley, there's one thing that, and I did talk to the speaker about this, but one of Brian Kemp's biggest campaign moves was to back a $5,000 pay increase for all teachers in Georgia. It is a hugely expensive venture. It would cost hundreds of millions of dollars. The speaker would not commit to it. He says his budget people are looking at it, and they have to kind of look at the long term impact it would have on state spending. But if you are one of the governor's floor leaders in the House and probably in the Senate too, that's probably going to be one of your heaviest lifts if a Governor Kemp goes through with that.
And I imagine some of these tax changes that we've talked about with paying for rural development, that's going to be a lift as well.
There's a perfect pot of money sitting over there, at least $100 million for the private school giveaway that could be eliminated.
You're talking about the tax credits and scholarships for that are available for private schools.
To put it nicely, I call it the private school giveaway. But in any event, that's $100 million that could be used to help fund teachers' salaries and increases. I think that'd be a great, great use of that money.
And Kemp has mentioned other sources of revenue above a baseline that Georgia has achieved because of the Trump tax cuts, et cetera. He's looked at a pot of money that he feels that he can make an argument for Georgia to do that without decreasing the choice that parents have for making education a priority for their children. Parents like myself who have used that tax credit to make sure my kids can afford a choice of an education that fits their needs and our vision for them.
Moving on, Tamar, I want to go back to you. You mentioned this earlier. There's this this criminal justice reform bill that's facing some uncertainty in the Senate. Republican Congressman Doug Collins from Northeast Georgia has been one of the champions of this. This would make it easier to commute some sentences. It would also change some other things as well. It has the support of the president, but it's being held up. Due to some opposition from Tom Cotton, who's a Republican senator from Arkansas, he says that it's too flawed, that it's too lenient. And then you have opposition as well from some liberal groups and civil rights groups who say it doesn't go far enough. What's the fate of this bill, do you think?
Sure. So this bill is one of kind of the only bipartisan areas of cooperation that we've seen on Capitol Hill that has a real passive chancing, a real chance of passing, I'm sorry. and this is something that they've been working on for years now. We thought a similar bill would pass during Obama's last few years as president. That ended up getting blocked. And this bill this year initially started from an effort that Doug Collins was quarterbacking in the House. And it was a much narrower effort that had to do with prison reform, which basically were programmed as prisoners were coming out of the system. They could shorten some of their sentences by going to halfway houses, participating in worker training, education, that sort of thing, designed to keep people out of prison once they're gone. There was some opposition from Democrats and civil rights groups. They wanted to make it broader, make changes to drug sentencing laws to help cut down on the disparities that you see from, some African Americans who are accused of crimes. And so the effort grew. Now, the problem is that there's opposition on the right now who claim that this will lead to criminals in the streets and that sort of thing. And that's where you're seeing some of this opposition from Tom Cotton, from the National Sheriff's Association. And that's what's caused the hiccup in the Senate. The president signed on to this, but the problem is that for the longest time, we didn't exactly know where Mitch McConnell stood on it. In general, he's been pretty tough on crime as well, but he also said if there was a majority of Senate Republicans who'd sign on, he could be willing to look at it. Right now, it does look like there's a narrow majority, but McConnell has been kind of telegraphing privately to the White House that he'd rather be focusing on other things in the next few weeks of this Congress. So it looks like this could die.
Tom, you covered this quite well when it came out, but this is a big deal. I think I always brag on Democrats, but this is a big deal that Doug Collins is now the ranking minority member on the Judiciary Committee. He leaped over several people, and this is a position of great influence in the House, and I think this is quite an accomplishment for him, and he'll be a major player in the deal.
I think also it's very important not to look at this as a release reformation. This is also a reforming of how inmates are treated internal to the prison. So it doesn't just deal with people being released early and whether or not they've been remediated. I mean, we're talking about the banning the shackling of pregnant inmates, women, and the way women are treated. You know, requiring that the Bureau of Prisons jail people within 500 miles of their family so they can have time to visit their family. Look, Doug Collins is he's a moral leader. He is a values-based leader. He's the son of a preacher. He is a preacher himself. I think that he is concerned about the care of families. He considers the First Step Act a very pro-woman, pro-family bill. And I think that it'll pass.
This is such a delicately crafted compromise. And I think the fear right now for people who do support this measure, including Chuck Grassley from Iowa, who's been the big champion in the Senate, is that any adjustments that are made to appease some of these people on the right, there's fear that you could start losing people on the left. And that's what you saw happen when the bill moved through the House earlier this year. You had people like John Lewis from Atlanta who said, no, we want to take this opportunity while we do have some sort of bipartisan consensus to make real changes to sentencing reform.
Tamara, isn't that what's happening when you see people like Van Jones, who is typically, the CNN commentator, considered somewhat of a leftist? Some people called him a Democrat socialist, but yet then he's agreeing with Donald Trump about prison reform. I mean, aren't sometimes Democrats pressured to be oppositional, even if it helps the constituents that they claim to care about the most?
You see this on both sides. You have your bases, given how polarized we are right now, you have the bases in both parties who are kind of pushing for the perfect bill. And I think what's been kind of lost over the last few years with all of this gridlock is this idea, if it moves the ball forward a little bit, maybe we should just take that opportunity. And the problem is that because the legislative process has been so blocked for so long, I think there's such pent-up demand to do anything that whenever anyone gets a little bit of an opportunity, everyone jumps and they want everything. 100% of what they want.
Right. We should mention as well that Doug Collins' ally in this effort is Hakeem Jeffries, who is an African American Democrat congressman from Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and actually somebody who he considers a close personal friend as well.
Exactly. And this is, he's seen as the new face of the Democratic Party.
And he's also the chair of the House Democratic Caucus.
Exactly. Right. He was just elected to be the number four position in the House Democratic Caucus, and he's moving up really fast. So it'll be very interesting to watch the two of them on the Judiciary Committee as they move up. This is a bill, who's to say, even if it dies this December on the Hill, it could very much be revived in the new year. But this delicate balance that I mentioned, all these negotiations that were made, might need to be renegotiated because Dems will have more power.
Didn't I read somewhere that the Republican and Democrat behind this criminal justice reform effort have shared hip hop playlists?
Oh yes, they called it Doug and Hakeem's Summer Jams. They made a little Spotify playlist that included country music, EDM, rap, R&B. It was very fun.
Interesting.
Tamar, you mentioned Republican Senate support for this bill. Where do Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue stand on it?
Okay, Johnny Isaacson is supportive of the bill. He says he sees it as an extension of what Nathan Deal has done on the state level. David Perdue has been a little more interesting. He's still undecided. He sent some very positive signals. He says he wants to get to a yes, but he's not quite there yet. And that's notable because he helped kill another, a little bit broader criminal justice reform effort back in 2016.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Tamar Halliman of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Also joining us is the AJC's Jim Galloway, Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, and Republican strategist Leo Smith. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you. Great job.
Thank you.
And we'll be back here tomorrow at 2 o'clock. There'll be lots to talk about, as always. Thanks for you for your questions and comments as well on Facebook and Twitter. And I'm Bradley George, and for Bill Nigut. We'll see you again tomorrow.